Councilmember Hampton Peters.
Present.
Mayor Pro Tem Matusik is excused. Mayor Masarsik is excused. Councilman Emter. Commissioner Curry.
Here.
Vice Mayor McGuirk.
Here.
Commissioner Stowers.
Here.
Councilmember Ford.
Here.
Vice Mayor Long.
Here.
Councilmember Daniels. Councilmember Patterson is excused. Councilmember Dennis.
Here.
Councilmember Cusack.
Here.
Councilmember Northy.
Here.
Councilmember Wagner is excused. Commissioner Basso.
Here.
Mayor Sal. Councilmember Saylor.
Here.
Councilmember Perone.
Here.
Mayor Jennings. Mayor Gibson's excused. Mayor Ordell.
Here.
Commissioner Shoup is excused. Linda Costello is excused. Clay Irvin.
Here.
Phyllis Blaze.
Here.
Bob Stork.
Here.
And we have a quorum. Okay, very good. Thank you. Stand for the Pledge of Allegiance, please.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, now we have public participation. We have two speakers. Big, we'll start with you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is that working? All right, Herb, is it loud enough, Herb? Okay. Herb doesn't like to turn the volume up. Madam Chair, I'm here this morning, Big John, 120 State Avenue on the Hill. I'm here this morning to rediscuss with all y'all, and I noticed that Joshua's not here, but the County Council, sooner at Princess Patty, I guess you're representing everybody today, but sooner or later we should really talk about a 1 cent local option sales tax so that you can pay for SunRail eventually and so that you can have some road building or road repairing money. Just a thought. Do you think you'll get to that item before the end of the year?
We can certainly plan for it. Lois?
I believe that what you're talking about is a county council action, or are you talking about the MPO itself?
I think anybody in charge of roads should be thinking about how you're going to fund them, and SunRail, which you've already contracted for and have no means of paying.
Yeah. In our existing long-range plan, we built that plan with a revenue element that was based on a half-cent sales tax, and that was after public outreach and a workshop of the board members at that point. As we construct the next long-range plan, we will, I guess, revisit. But I don't think that Federal Highway is going to allow us to use a 1 cent for any sales tax because there hasn't been any motion, in that direction. But we'll be working with them on that, and we'll continue to discuss that through the MPO. But as you probably know, and for everybody, for everybody's benefit, the MPO can't initiate that sort of activity. We can support it, and we can indicate whether or not this board is interested in how we would like to participate in that, but we can't initiate it.
What is the long-range plan for paying for SunRail?
Well, the current obligation from the county is out of the general revenue fund. It's the only source that they have.
Just a thought, Ms. Denny's. Sorry to bother you, Ms. Denny's, while you're hitting on Mr. Ford. But at any rate, it's a serious concern. School board's out there, and you guys are not. A thought. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, Big.
All right, next we have Jacob Sachs.
Good morning to my esteemed board. I'm your citizens advisor from New Smyrna Beach. In reference to last month's presentation by Space Interests, I am opposed to the taking of Merritt Island National Wildlife Refuge for a commercial launch facility or for any other purpose. This land grab will diminish the nation's inventory of public lands. It is these public lands of the national park system that are among America's most valuable assets. Desecrating any portion of the wildlife refuge is an egregious breach of promise and negates the mission statement of the United States Fish and Wildlife Service to conserve a network of lands to protect and enhance fish and wildlife, plants and their habitats, and for the continuing benefit of the American people. The environmental impact to this small and necessary buffer of land will be catastrophic. NASA has indicated that toxic plumes of hazardous chemicals have contaminated the soil and ground around the KSC. The most prevalent is trichloroethane. They have found ammonia and volatile organic compounds as well. These chemicals are carcinogenic and cause birth defects. So far, millions of dollars have been spent for environmental cleanup at the KSC and the Air Force Base. Why would Americans want any more of this catastrophic pollution and then pay to clean up the lethal mess with our tax dollars? The fuels used to propel rockets are poisonous, explosive, and incompatible with life. At best, byproducts of kerosene that does not combust, called coking, will rain down on our precious lagoon. That's on a good day. If an anomaly occurs, our refuge will be doused with propellants such as monomethylhydrazine, nitrogen tetroxide, ethyl methyl bad stuff. Who knows what dangerous cargoes and experiments might accidentally crash on us and our fragile estuary. We do not want these hazardous operations any closer to us than they are now. The human exposure to risk is too high. The frequent closing of our national seashore and national wildlife refuge is also problematic. We should not be denied access to our public land every time a launch occurs. With 50 to 200 missions a year possible, the impact will be immense and deleterious to the quality of life for our surrounding communities. The future of our wildlife hangs in the balance. Volusia County relies heavily on an ecotourist-based economy. Birding, fishing, hunting, they're all part of that base. Without a healthy lagoon, our economy will die, and the 18 endangered species that live within the Minwar will die with them. Our lagoon system is already an impaired water body. It is in distress. Scientists are not sure of the cause, but signs point to overdevelopment, improper resource management, and pollution. Shiloh has had prior impact studies, and they have failed. What is different now? We live here, and all you have to do is listen to Mother Nature, and she will tell you that something's wrong. Sometimes the water's brown, sometimes it's green. It's rarely clear anymore. I've noticed less seagrass, less marine life. Pelican, manatee, dolphin are all dying. My family no longer eats the shellfish. It is irresponsible, callous, foolhardy, wrong-minded to increase space activities in this sensitive area. The Shiloh Project will violate the Department of Transportation Section 4F, which cannot approve the use of land from publicly owned parks, recreational areas, wildlife and waterfowl refuges, or public and historical sites. That land is all of these. Keep future commercial space activities confined to the KSC. We do not want additional abandoned launch sites and spoiled and contaminated resources in our future. Fishing guides tell me they smell chemicals in the Southern Mosquito Lagoon for days after a launch. I've also been told by a space contractor they have to scrub down the launch pad after a launch before people can safely approach. What happens with the water from acoustic dampening? What happens with the water used to scrub down the launch pads? Where does it all go? The proximity of the Shiloh site, forgive me, I'm almost finished. The proximity of the Shiloh site to the Intracoastal Waterway, Interstate Highway 95, and several neighboring communities is too close. Previously, a launch anomaly caused local citizens to close their windows at home and stay indoors for a while. We know there is bad stuff in the air. We have also seen videos of several launch anomalies at the KSC on YouTube. You can see them too. They're scary looking. A public forum was sponsored by Space Florida and local politicians last year in New Smyrna Beach. Were there. Citizens packed the room and overwhelmingly opposed this project. The FAA should take note, and please, the board, take note. Shiloh is a no-go. Maybe the FAA could suggest that space entrepreneurs go to Los Alamos or White Sands. Rocket engineers are already considering the future of nuclear motors, which they propose to get through Broward County. I hope to God they don't come through here. Maybe the site of the first atom bomb would be an appropriate place to test those. Thank you for your time.
No further public comment. Okay, that brings us back to the consent agenda. Do we have a motion to approve, or does anyone have an item that they wish to remove?
Motion to approve the consent agenda.
Okay, Rob, and second was Jason. Okay. Any discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed? Okay. All right, moving on to action items. We have review and approval of Resolution 2014-09, amending the 2013-14 to 2017-18 Transportation Improvement Program.
Lois. Thank you, Madam Chair. We basically have five items that have been listed out in your agenda pretty clearly here, and I just want to call your attention to two of those items. On page 32, the very last item, VOTRAN section 5339, bus and bus facility funding. This is some new funding, but we just have a minor error under the fund source column. We list all of the funding as FTA funding, when in fact the second and third row, the $125,000 and the $123,000, those should reflect local funds. So FTA funding does require a match, so the second and third rows there under the fund source should be changed from FTA to LF, local funds. In addition, the item for the systems interchange, is here, but there's been a bit of a communications issue between the Department of Transportation and Federal Highway and the NPO, and this project, the systems interchange and the lane widening, were combined into a singular project. When we originally approved this in the TIP back in November, when we were preparing it, we entered it as if it was an independent project. And at the time, it still was, even though I think the DOT knew they were heading in this direction. And really what this is doing is just combining the widening project and the interchange project to be done at a single time. And we've discussed that before, and the DOT has discussed that as a part of their work program since then. So technically, we're not changing the cost, the limits, or any other significant details to the project, which means it really doesn't require an amendment. It can be done as an administrative modification, which is paperwork we've already processed. But because we had already started this process, because it goes above and beyond, because we've been communicating it clearly, we have just left it as a part of this TIP amendment. It really is kind of a behind-the-scenes issue, but I just wanted to make it clear to you all that we are processing it, continuing to include it as this amendment, just to close the loop on what we've set in motion. So with that, I'll entertain any questions or a motion to approve.
Any questions for Lois?
For Lois, it's just the one change on the
local funding.
Bus and bus facility. So I'll make a motion to approve with the change
second.
In funding to the bus and bus facility.
Pat seconds. All right. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Anyone opposed? All right, next action item is the review and approval of Resolution 2014-10 amending the 2012-2013 and 2013-2014 Unified Planning Work Program and authorizing the deobligation of PL funds for the current federal fiscal year. And
so,
okay, Lois?
Cover it. There is a process that is allowed to occur where we have unspent money in our existing UPWP. If we deobligate it within a particular time frame, we can make that money available for use in the next UPWP, which we reviewed last month as a draft. And so we have built that new UPWP knowing that we would have some carryover money. The total is $130,000 of carryover money. And we've done that a number of times in the past here at this TPO. Most specifically, as I mentioned, I think in previous discussions, we've had a planner position vacant for the last, just over the last year actually, which has allowed us to reserve or set aside or not use a certain amount of funding. And we had kept that position in the budget. We had looked at filling it, but in looking at the finances a little more, I wanted to put that off. We have removed that position completely from the budget for this fiscal year, so that's freed up a bit of money. And then there's some unspent money from projects that we just haven't drawn down. So we've already allocated that in the new UPWP that'll take effect in June, And this is just the formal action needed to free up the funds from the existing in order to make it available when we start the new UPWP.
Okay, any questions?
Motion to approve.
Second.
Okay, any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Okay. Moving now into presentations, we have the Volusia TPO's Community Transportation Survey Instrument. And I think that's Jean. Nope.
Well, I'll go ahead and discuss that as well. In this particular instance, last month, we had a brief presentation about the survey itself, and there was a desire to come back and take a look at that survey instrument, and that has been included in your packet. Just as a reminder, this is a survey that we intend to do every other year. Each time you do it, you're reaching out to new folks that maybe you haven't touched before. As important initially as it is to get feedback as a result of this survey, what we are really using this for to a great extent this time around is to reach out to our business partners in the community as well as citizens. We're getting ready to start the long-range plan. We're changing the name of the organization. We're expanding our planning area boundaries. And so for us, this is a big opportunity to promote the organization and to get our name out there every bit as much as it is to get information. And again, with this particular survey, it's intended to be very, very brief so that we can generate a lot of interest. We'll be using it hopefully to build a database if folks are interested in having their contact information submitted. And we hope to launch that at next month's meeting. The survey was developed with a stakeholder group that involved the Department of Transportation and VOTRAN, as well as members from the Technical Coordinating Committee. And it has been reviewed and approved by the advisory committees. We do have the consultant here if you have any specific questions. And if there are any particular comments, then we would go ahead and take those and incorporate them before next month's meeting when we plan to have a big launching.
Any questions, Pat?
Yeah. Lois, how is this survey instrument going to be distributed again?
It's primarily online, but we'll be doing print copies as well as Spanish versions.
Okay. And those copies will, how will we make sure that the bilingual community, the Spanish community knows that there's?
The same way we do outreach everywhere, which is trying to contact those communities, reach out specifically to them, using the various avenues on VOTRAN vehicles, as well as reaching out through press and organizations that we've identified.
Then is this intended to be specifically for other modals of transportation, modalities of transportation, or is this, because you just said VOTRAN, is this also, who is the audience on this?
Everybody. The audience is
okay.
Everybody. Citizens as well as businesses, but we'll be working with Team Volusia. We've been talking to the chambers and a lot of different groups that will help us. One voice for Volusia, so we've got advocacy groups. So we'll be really trying to target.
Can we maybe get
community.
A list of those outreach efforts, who
sure.
you're going to
Absolutely.
Outreach to in case we have others that we'd like to see added to that?
Yes.
Could probably be emailed. All right, any other questions or comments? Yes, Barbara?
Lois, you mentioned a lot of Volusia County entities and everything that you just said. Is this to include Barbara County?
Absolutely, yeah. This particular, you know, we're in that strange period where we're not allowed to spend planning funds outside of our area. But in this particular case, we are using local funds, so there are no restrictions. And yes, it is intended to target.
Because I think all the cities and the county would maybe put a link on their websites mm-hmm. and do a little byline. We usually have hot items and things like that are pop-ups. But our Chamber of Commerce is really good about sending out our economic development entity is doing business surveys. We're working with our ag people and a variety of other types of things that we're polling our community. And we could probably use their help as well.
Absolutely. Again, for us, this is a big partnership-building activity. activity as well. And I think when you, when the consultant is here next month to launch, they'll get into a little bit of that detail. But in the meantime, I'll send out that stakeholder list so that you all can see it. And if there are any additional suggestions and contacts, we would greatly appreciate it.
Ron?
Has the school board got on board with this yet?
Adam, can you speak to the school's involvement in this?
Yes.
I know they've been contacted.
Yes, they've been contacted. The school board, as many of you know, is the largest employer within Volusia County, typical of most counties within in the state of Florida. They have been contacted, and we are hoping to coordinate with them to disseminate the survey there as well.
Okay, any further questions or comments? All right, thank you. Next is presentation of the draft public participation plan update.
One of the most important activities that we have here at the TPO is our public outreach. And we complete that in a variety of ways through our advisory committees, through press releases, attendance at events. All of that activity is guided by our public participation plan. We update that on a somewhat routine basis every couple of years, really. We go through it, make sure that it's current for any changes in Florida law, in best practices. Now, when we have a particular project, like the long-range transportation plan, we'll develop a specific plan just for that activity. But I think in terms of public outreach, this TPO does a very, very good job for an eight-person organization getting out there in the community at events and the like. So that being said, we've updated this public participation plan. We've done it sensitive to the fact that we're changing our planning area boundaries. It is so important from a federal level that the requirement for that is a 45-day public review. So it makes it kind of clear that they intend for this document to be reviewed and to take your time in approving it. So we've developed the update. It's been available on the website. We'll have that out for public review and then bring it back at our May meetings, because obviously 45 days won't pass before our April meetings. So if you have any specific comments about that document or about what we do, by all means, Pam Blankenship in our office has taken the lead on updating that document and any additional, and making sure that it's implemented. So any additional comments that you might have, we'd be happy to take them.
Okay, any questions or comments? All right. And now we have presentation of the Veterans Memorial Bridge design.
I know you haven't been able to take your eyes off.
Good morning. My name is Jim White. I'm the project manager for Volusia County for the Veterans Memorial Bridge project. Just over 2 weeks ago, we had a public information meeting here in Daytona Beach on the project. It was very well attended. About 75, 80 people came, and it was very well received. And we're going to run through our presentation from that night, kind of give you an update on what's going on with our project. So with that, I'd like to introduce from our design team, from Parsons Printerhoff, Adrian Moon. He's going to give the presentation. And also here from our design team is Justin Barton from Giavi Associates.
Thank you. I'd also like to introduce Shel Kendall, our Orlando area manager, who is also here with us. We've done this presentation a couple times now. I think we went a little long, so I've done an abbreviated version of this as to not bore you. I guess I'm just going to run through this. Primarily what we want to focus on, I'm going to start off by introductions we've done. Project history, I think we all should be aware of the history of this. It's a movable structure, a movable bridge structure, older in age. Needs to be replaced. Obviously, it gets stuck a lot. There's high maintenance costs. That's a burden, of course, on the county's budget. There's clearance issues in the channel for the U.S. Coast Guard. So these are the number of reasons it was put through this process. The first part of it was a PD&E study. Obviously, that was completed in October of 2011 before we started our design phase. We started in the spring of 2013. Fundamentally, I think the what came out of the PD&E obviously was that it had to be a high-level structure, which was opposed by the community to some extent. And also that to help with that process, that we were going to insert a project advisor committee as part of that, as part of the design phase, to really ensure that the public's desires, wishes, intentions were well reflected in the bridge, and also that they were, that they could take ownership in the project too, and so that to kind of help mitigate some of the concerns. As Jim mentioned, we just had this public hearing 2 weeks ago. I would consider it a success. We had 80 to 100 people there, 80 signed in. We had a number of our PAC committee members attend, which was wonderful, and some of them are here today also. And we gave a presentation. I think the punchline from the public hearing was that, public meeting rather, was that a couple years ago we had this meeting, and we didn't have it, but it was held, and there was a lot of, it was contentious. And this meeting was described to some extent as a love fest, and I would attribute that to the process that we undertook as part of this, which is the PAC process, which was, I think, you know, incredibly successful. Again, a couple of numbers are here today. We've met 9 times now with the PAC committee monthly. We'll have our 10th meeting next week. Again, it's a committee that's composed of both elected officials and community representative fishermen. And so we've met monthly. And the process has been basically to say, okay, first we're going to walk in the room, we're going to explain some of the technical issues, some of the concerns, the cost issues, some of the challenges, get feedback, come back to them with alternatives that they can mull over and discuss, refine those alternatives, and come back to them. And I'm just going to walk you, I guess, real briefly, if I can, through the process that we went through with them. I think right off the bat we wanted to decide, just because of design schedule limitations, we needed to decide what kind of bridges are going to be. So obviously it's high level, that doesn't mean we know what kind of structure type it's going to be. There were a number, a conventional beam option, enhanced concrete beam, a segmental bridge, sort of like ISB, to the North International Speedway Boulevard Bridge, and a arch bridge. Ultimately, when we kind of went through all these options, aesthetics really wasn't the forefront of the discussion. The forefront of the discussion was the fact that these bridges become incredibly steep in nature, in terms of when you start to go high level and you have these condensed, compressed areas. So really the committee's main thought process was, hey, let's keep this bridge low, and we were on board with that, so that really kind of lends itself to the arch design. Now this one, obviously, that you see the sketch of, it was just very preliminary to kind of show, but the secret to the arch, or whatever, is that in this instance, the structure, the load is carried from above and not below, and so that thins up the whole structural profile. And that lets you push the profile down, i.e. it's less steep, it's lower in the air. So this bridge will actually be about 10 feet, the roadway surface will be about 10 feet lower than ISB overall. So in moving out of that, we said, okay, the design we want to move forward is arch options for the thinness of profile. PAC meeting number two, again, it was an introduction. We started going over some of the veterans memorial elements. Obviously a big portion of this project, why it's so significant, is the Veterans Memorial aspect. We really wanted to make that special, and so did the committee. So we kind of undertook a process, which I'll finish up a little bit later. Just what kind of elements are used around the country for these type of situations? And what do we want to do here? What do we think was appropriate specifically for Volusia County? Came back to them at PAC meeting number three. Okay, here's a couple, you know, four different alternatives. We explored numerous ideas. These are the ones we kind of landed on as the most constructible, most feasible. Really all we wanted from them at this meeting was some feedback on, we had two modern designs and two more historic designs, and we wanted feedback on which ones they liked in terms of the style, and then just eliminate one of these options so that we could take the other three forward through an initial engineering process which would estimate costs and constructability and such. Ultimately, the sky arch was one of the modern options that was let go of. The concentric wave was held on to as a more modern option that was liked by a number of committee members, but overwhelmingly, I think the feeling we got from the committee was that a historic option, something that uses coquina, a local construction material that's very prevalent in the older structures around, was going to be the right way to go. So we took these three designs forward into the design process. Again, meeting number four, an introduction to fishing piers. There was also a commitment from the PD&E, because this was now becoming a low-level structure, or a high-level structure from a low-level structure that allowed fishing. The high-level structure, you can't fish from. So part of the commitment from the PD&E was to provide fishing piers on both the east and west sides to allow for that activity. PAC 5 is a status update. We started introducing pier styles. I think the thing to emphasize is that we came back to them with every element we could think of for consideration and kind of mulled it over with the committee, showed them the concerns. I think another thing that we wanted to point out was that the committee was incredibly cost-conscious, by the way, in this decision-making process, really kind of opting in. In this instance, when it came to pier styles, a lot of the folks liked the diamond-shaped pier style you see in the middle here, but we let them know that, hey, that's a more expensive pier style, and said it uses a lot of concrete that is unnecessary. It's extra. And so we waived that off at this meeting and went along with the flat face design. It was actually more consistent with the open spandrel bridge design you see in front of you. And so, yeah, we wiped out one of those and kept moving forward. Okay, so as I mentioned, we kind of brought it down to three alternatives, and then those were going to move forward through the bridge development report process. This is just a report that kind of covers, again, cost, aesthetic is part of this consideration in this instance. Safety, ADA compliance, very important. Constructability, overall schedule of construction. Obviously, this was going to be a detour project. The bridge is going to be built exactly on the existing alignment, so we want to keep that construction schedule very short, which helps with cost, but also reduces the detour time. And then other elements like hydraulics and environmental also part of that study. I'm not going to get into the details on this, but again, just to give you an idea of the kind of stuff we looked at, precast versus cast in place as elements. Of the three designs we were thinking about moving forward with, which ones use the most concrete that was cast off-site? That's more efficient, it's better quality, it's better for the environment. So again, that was a major component of our analysis. Very unique stuff also in this project. Obviously, we had a lot of concerns about, if you will, the cross-section of the bridge, the view of the bridge. It was going to be now a high-level bridge where there was a low-level one before. What would that mean in terms of your view shed, if you will? And so we actually did an analysis, like a quantitative analysis, of what the visual cross-section of the bridge would be from different angles and kind of gave that a score and a ranking and included that in the report as well. Again, because their concern, as Nancy knows, was the views from Lillian Place and such, how much mass would be in front of you. So we tried to, again, reduce that and look for options that really helped in that aspect. Constructability, how is the bridge going to get built? A big part of the process also lends to cost and speed. Again, we're not going to get into details of this, but you can see we did extensive analysis on how this thing can be put together over the channel while maintaining, you know, boat traffic. Ultimately, at the end of the day, what you get out of the BDR was a ranking system. These were all the different criteria. We applied weights to those, working with the county. Overwhelmingly, option A, the open spandrel, really kind of led the way. It was the cheapest alternative. It met most of the criteria. It was number one in a lot of categories, so it really was the hands-on favorite. And so we took that back to the committee and kind of explained, you know, that process and how that went and discussed it with them. PAC 6, we covered lighting. Again, in this instance, cost was a major consideration. Metroscape was a chosen light. This is an LED design. So again, long-term maintenance is lower. Electrical cost is lower on a daily basis. These are slightly shorter also to kind of be in keeping with the historical look of the bridge, and so they're more frequent along the bridge. When you look at the aesthetic type fixtures that we looked at, this was the cheapest and most economical from a long-term standpoint that can be selected. Talked about color, the color of the lighting on the bridge from an aesthetic standpoint. Everyone agreed that we wanted to go with something warm. You get an idea of the depth we went into, though, with this committee. In terms of the choices and selections. Again, there's a look at the bridge. You can see a little bit here. With the warm lighting kind of up on the piers, that's kind of what we're going to be moving forward with in terms of aesthetic lighting design. PAC number 7, we hammered out pier styles. Again, went back to them, took their input, went back to them, come up with some options. Option number 1 is what's selected, and you see on the model here today. The other option, part of that, was the overlook shape. Debated what, you know, would be the most efficient shape for those overlooks. Overlooks occur, as you can see on the model, at every pier location. There's another element of that. Again, with the Veterans Memorial aspect of this being so important to the committee, to us, to everyone, one of the features of this project is that as you kind of walk around the bridge, we wanted this kind of circuitous route where there's these storyboards, if you will, on each of these overlooks that kind of tell a story of our nation's history in regards to our veterans. The details of those boards are to be worked out by our veterans subcommittee, but it'll be a nice little journey across and around the bridge and back to the park. PAC meeting number 8. Surprisingly, this was the most contentious of our meetings, as Nancy can attest to. It went for 2 hours, I think. And that's great. That's what we want as consultants. I want a room full of energized, excited people who have passion. And so we presented them with two alternatives, A and B, and it was a split decision, both with our subcommittee and our primary advisory committee. And we tried to vote on it 4 or 5 different ways, and it just didn't work. I don't know if you had that problem here ever. It was 50-50 split, absolutely, in the room each time. So it was my job to go back and come up with an option D, as we called it, which was a blend of the two alternatives. I think, just in summary, I mean, I think half of the group liked the amphitheater design because it allowed for events. It was a nice open space. The other design, which we're calling the trench or spine, was a more secluded memorial-type space that allowed for reflection and appreciation for the veterans. The spine along the middle was to hold the names of the Volusia County fallen soldiers along that edge. And so, again, they had two different feels to them, and it was decided that we wanted something that was a compromisable. So that's what we did. We just built kind of the spine into the amphitheater. And when we came back to the next meeting, presented this to the committee, and again, there was overwhelming support for this option. And so that's what we're moving forward with. Okay, so this is just a summary of the PAC recommendations. I guess what, if I haven't beaten it to death already, what I want to really, if you leave with one thing today from this, it's that this PAC, we're really proud of this PAC process, and we felt it really worked. I think we have a committee full of people that contributed to this design in a legitimate way. They believe this is part born from their ideas, and it is truly that. We didn't try and interject our will or opinion in any way. We really tried to go back to them and everything. I think I've talked to a lot of architects and engineers over the years who say you can't legislate design, you can't vote on design, you can't design by committee is what they say. I think I disagree. I think this project is an example of what you can, and it can be successful, and you can come up with a beautiful and very functional alternative for the public that everyone can embrace. And I think the reception at the public hearing last week or the week before was evidence of that, I hope. Design schedule. We've just submitted 60% civil plans and 30% bridge plans. This whole thing's scheduled to be wrapped up in the fall, where we'll have another public hearing in the fall, and then construction hopefully the spring of next year, 2015. Real quick, there's a lot of resources. I'm not sure if you guys have been on the website. All these images, photo simulations, a lot of the documentation from the PAC meetings is on the website. Obviously, you can contact us or the county, Jim, if you need any information, we'd be happy to supply it to you. We're working on a video right now to kind of put on the website and use for public involvement purposes as well. And with that, thank you very much. I don't want to take too much of your time.
Okay. Comments. I don't know who was first, Joyce or Pat? Joyce?
I was.
Okay.
I just want to say thanks to that PAC committee and to all of the folks that were involved with the design. I was at the first meeting when it was finally decided that we were going to have to build this bridge. And it was truly an experience. There was utterly chaos. And as a council member, I was one of the two, and we were really beat up pretty bad about the bridge. So I decided I'd go back to your meeting 2 weeks ago to see if the spirit of the bridge and the necessity of that bridge, if the folk in the area had changed their opinion. And I was pleased to know that there was such buy-in by the citizens. There were, you know, maybe one or two people that were still not so satisfied that we have to have the bridge. But that PAC committee made a tremendous impact, and they were there at the final meeting 2 weeks ago and was very supportive. They had input, buy-in. It was a community effort. So I just want to say to that PAC committee and to the staff of Volusia County, who was also a part of that whipping that first meeting, and to all of the engineers and architects and designers that I think we have a class act project here now. And not only is the project good for veterans and for history, but it's also a bridge for that we can use for transportation that is so necessary. It's the low maintenance. I think that it's entertainment in as much as there's the fishing pier, and I think they're going to be able to work things through as it relates to the Lillian Place and that property there. So I, as a member, am very pleased with the outcome, knowing from where we came to where we are today. It's really a delight. Thank you all so much, and thank to all the PAC group for all your work. Thank you.
Thank you. Could you, a couple of different things. When the council first was talking about this, I had understood we were going to have fishing piers on each end, and one of those fishing piers has now morphed into an amphitheater. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct.
Okay, so there are still...
Yeah, there'll be fishing piers.
And where did the amphitheater come
they're
in?
They're not... the amphitheater is a memorial element. As
okay,
a
that's
a
memorial element?
The amphitheater, I don't like to call it an amphitheater. I mean, it's
well,
a
you called it that.
It's a Veterans Memorial Park.
Okay.
Or plaza that will get, it'll be there for remembrance. The names of the fallen soldiers will be there, and also it'll be available for veterans events. But yes, there are fishing piers on both ends.
On the
north side of the bridge, on both ends, underneath the bridge. I don't have those here. The design of those here today. They're simple. I think they're going to be wood structures at this point, and they'll lead out in the shade along that north edge of the bridge, and kind of just go out as far as they can towards the channel.
And what about the pedestrian elements of this bridge? That was very critical to the council, and I didn't hear you say a word about that.
I apologize. That's a huge consideration. I think one of the things, just to begin with, when you think about the cross-section of this bridge and the percentage of it that's for the pedestrian, it really is more of a pedestrian structure, or as much a pedestrian structure as it is for vehicular traffic. Obviously, for pedestrians, we've tried to lower the profile so that it's not as steep. Also, the sidewalks, a 5-foot standard has been changed to 8-foot. To get a lot more room. You also have the overlooks.
And it was to be designed so bikers could access it. And how will that happen with this design?
Absolutely. I mean, bikers can use either the 8-foot sidewalk area, again, which is wider, so that it'll allow for bikes and pedestrians where there isn't too much of an issue. I think somebody, it was Jerry Britton, who brought it up on the out at ISD. You have a 5-foot area, and it's steep at times, and it's dangerous to have pedestrians and bikers kind of in the same area. In that 5-foot area. So there's two options here. Some of the more experienced cyclists can use the roadway, which they often do. And then recreational cyclists can use the 8-foot, large, increased 8-foot area for pedestrians and cyclists.
And is that being designed so that bicyclists can actually bicycle it?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, some of the elements, I mean, there's obviously the grade of these bridges.
Well, that was an issue. I could recall having that conversation
and
about the grade.
For ADA
of the
reasons,
issue.
there's landings. And it's a 10-foot land. It's 10 or 12-foot landing.
5 foot every 30 feet.
Now those are increased because what we're doing is we're coordinating the landings, the flat spaces with the overlook. So the overlook, which is 12 feet wide, will have a 12-foot flat area for rest, okay. so to speak, along there. And then they go up at 30 feet, and then they have landings everywhere. So yes, it has been a huge focus. And to that end, I might add is another element that we're incorporating is pass-throughs underneath the bridge, so that pedestrians don't have to cross over the roadway, that they can go underneath and around and back up. So one of the things, what I mentioned before, is this kind of circuitous route that if I walk in here, circuitous route for the memorial, you kind of come up here and down, and then you get, instead of crossing the road here, you have the opportunity to cross underneath and back up. So you completely safe from traffic. We have the same thing across over on the west side as well.
Thank you.
Rob? I guess this has been going on for, about 4 years now? It seems to me it's been, and I'll tell you, if you want a good example, getting back to Councilperson Kuzak's comments about the original kickoff, and it was, I can actually point back to a person that was on the Daytona Commission who came out and spread a lot of misinformation in the community about the project, about the way it was going to happen. And it got everybody off on the wrong foot. And Commissioners Lentz and White, that represent this area now, have been very involved and have shown very strong leadership. And I think that's one of the major reasons you see that change in attitude for the people that actually are the stakeholders in the immediate area. And they really have done a great job of making sure that the public participation was important, it was valuable, it was going to be taken into consideration as the project moved forward. And, you know, it really, if you ever want to understand how a elected official can get a project going in the wrong direction, just go back and look what happened about 4 years ago. But I do have one question, though, and I hate to do this because I'm basing it off something I read in a newspaper article. But my understanding is there is no funding available for the Veterans Plaza, that is not part of the project, that would have to come through another means. Is that accurate?
That's accurate, yes.
Okay.
As the deputy project manager, I don't have all information on this, and maybe Jim can chime in if he wants to. But
right now, we've got the bridge funded. We work closely with DOT, got federal bridge funds and other district discretionary federal funds to fund the bridge. We did get the fishing piers funded. They're a commitment to PD&E as a replacement for not being able to fish off the bridge, so we did get that funded as well. I'm not sure if that was federal or state funds. We were having a little working on one thing at a time.
Yeah, the plaza itself, because it's in all the renderings, and we really are kind of making a promise that that's going to happen, but yet we haven't identified funding. That's the part that's got me a little concerned as we move forward to make sure that we either we find that funding or we make sure that people understand that this is an element that may not occur.
Correct. And I think Councilman Wagner, he's the head of our committee, is looking for funds. He's spearheading that. But we're looking for funds, but we're going to have it all designed and shovel ready so that it's easier to find funds. We've got the design funded, and that's if we come across as saying that's funded, that's a mistake on our part. That won't be something that we'll be able to get federal funds for, unless it's a different type of federal fund. So right now we're currently searching for funds, but we're trying to wrap it up as one big project so that we can do it together. It might be easier to get funds.
You're next.
Just an engineering question. I saw you pre sailboat going underneath the bridge. What's the clear span?
65. Okay, any more questions? Big, go ahead.
How long does Hardy have any good works for the Wonderland boat?
Approximately 2 years.
When do we start?
Early 2015.
Pat?
Can I go back to... Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Pat.
Can I go back to the Veterans Plaza and the concern that Rob has expressed? The county has a policy on construction projects that up to, I think, 0.5% of the cost of the project is an art and public places requirement. I mean, we require art and public places on all our construction projects. Is that element been added into this? Because that would be I would think that wouldn't that qualify as the art in public places element? Was that discussed at all with the committee, art in public places?
I don't think we talked about it as art in public places.
Because that's a county ordinance.
We've got aesthetic elements on the bridge itself, and then the across the bridge with the overlooks and the plaques.
And so would that is that what you're qualifying as art in public places, Jim?
I'll have to go back.
Okay. All right. Can we just check that out? Because it would seem to me that part of that plaza would qualify under that description, I believe.
Okay, Lois?
If I could just add one comment. When I first moved to Volusia County 15 years ago to work at this TPO, the St. John's River Bridge was being planned and about to be built, and everybody was excited because funding had been advanced. And there was discussion at the TPO board, and again, I was new to local government, new to this area, but there was discussion about that being a gateway into this community. And I went off with that,
very naively and sat in a room full of technical staff and engineering staff, and I mentioned that. And I got, as Councilman Cusack mentioned earlier, beat up about how this was supposed to be a functional bridge and that that just adds to the project cost and so on and so forth. And I was kind of stunned by it, but I just want to say I'm so excited that that sentiment has changed, and that from the staff level, from the county's perspective, and from the DOT, there's recognition that this is a major infrastructure project in the heart of a community that becomes either a visual asset or a functional asset, and that it really serves more than just a single purpose. And so as we build major infrastructure projects that are going to be here 80 and 100 years from now, that we have to look at every day, that is a really important element of quality of life and building communities and places. So I really want to say that it's exciting, and I'm very proud and congratulate the county for their efforts through the PAC and the City of Daytona Beach to really make this a beautiful project.
Okay. No more comments. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And then we go on to presentation of the Central Florida Safe Routes webpage and data analysis tools.
I'm going to go ahead and introduce Stephen Harris, our bike ped planner, and he's going to introduce some folks from the RPC about this project.
In 2012, the East Central Florida Regional Planning Council received a Safe Routes to School grant from FDOT to develop and implement a regional web page and data analysis tools. Ms. Tara McHugh is the project manager of the East Central Florida Regional Planning Council, and she's here today to tell you about this exciting project.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. As Stephen said, I'm Tara McHugh. I'm the Director of Planning at the East Central Florida Regional Planning Council. And what I'm going to talk to you about is the Central Florida Safe Routes Portal. It's our regional approach to all things safe routes, as you'll see through the presentation. It really is all things. The project came about because of our 2060 SRPP plan, which obviously came about from the regional vision. In our strategic regional policy plan, we have policies to promote local governments and agencies to include safe routes guidelines, complete streets, and appropriate school siting in their various plans and processes. Because as you all know, you can't have transportation planning, land use planning, and school planning without talking. They all affect each other, and everybody has a responsibility in that planning to create a healthy, connected community. And within that, everybody needs to talk. So the question was, how do we get everybody talking, promote these policies so everybody is on the same page so they don't have competing interests? We wanted to look at transportation, schools, economic, health, and land use. So the idea was, let's create a one-stop shop for everybody: data, resources, presentations, collaboration, and outreach. So initially in 2011, we pulled together some stakeholders who were very forward-thinking in Safe Routes. Obviously, Volusia TPO, Stephen Harris, was a participant in this, because you guys have been working on Safe Routes for a number of years. And we asked them the question, what will help you? What will help your jurisdictions, your decision makers? And we came up with a whole bunch of ideas, and one of them was to create an interactive map, collect all the data that all these decision makers and staff members need in order to create a project or identify issues. So what we did was we piloted a interactive tool in Eustis, because Lake Sumter MPO was undergoing their data collection for their safe access study. So we presented this information to DOT and the whole concept and proposal, and they loved the idea. They thought that it would be very beneficial for the region and very progressive, because this had not been done in the state of Florida or really in the United States. So we got the funding, and we pulled together a small technical advisory committee, which consisted of Lake Sumter MPO, Volusia TPO, and other safe routes to school entities, as well as school districts. We sat down initially and talked about, what is this portal? What is this website going to be? And the idea was, again, everything for everybody. Let's get as much into one place. So this is the place to go to in order to get answers and data. So these were all the concepts that we delved into. And that created our front page and the whole setup of our webpage, CentralFloridaSafeRoutes.org. I will not go through the entire website. It's really cool, very interactive. So please, I encourage you to do that on your own. But as you can see, we did address all the stakeholders we were talking about. Everybody has their bubbles. Decision makers, community involvement, parents, the kids have their own page. And then on the bottom, you'll see a number of tools that we developed that are for everybody, for the entire community. We have resources, a video library, which includes not only videos from the RPC, but across the state of Florida and the U.S., and a toolbox and calendar, which we try to update with events. So when you go back to your jurisdictions and you know that a school or an event or an agency has something going on, please just send me the information. I would love to announce it on our webpage and keep that going. The page that mostly pertains to you as a board would be the decision maker and policy page. It's actually one of our most popular pages. It does contain directly our policies that we put in the SRPP to help your agencies and jurisdictions start having that conversation of including policies in your plans when you update it. We also went through our resources that we collected from across the United States and pulled out those that would be relevant to the questions you would ask. Why is it important to me as a local politician? Why is it important to my community? How much is it going to cost me? What am I going to get on my return? So there's a lot of presentations and documents there to answer those specific questions. And of course, on the left side of the screen, we have our Protect the Journey video. That is our 5-minute video geared towards decision makers across different agencies to reiterate the fact that everybody has a different stake in creating healthy communities and school siting and getting kids safely to school. Everybody has a different responsibility in that process. Our other page that I wanted to quickly talk about was our toolbox. This is what Stephen talked about was we developed a bunch of tools for staff members and even the public to access to help make decisions and identify issues and make their life a little bit easier. I'm going to quickly go through them. The first one is the Safe Routes Calculator. It was our first tool we released. It's pretty basic, but it's really interesting, especially for if you want a quick snapshot at the impact of bicycling or walking to school. Parents can do it, students can do it, and our goal is to eventually expand on this to work with school districts to find out the cost of cutting out buses in relation to walking and biking to school. So you can put in how many trips you take, how long you go for, and it tells you the impacts, environmental impacts, money impacts, things like that. The next one is the map gallery and interactive map. We collected so much data across the region and standardized it across the board because, as you all know, one jurisdiction doesn't relay things the same way another jurisdiction does in their data. And there's also a lot of data gaps that we did identify, and that's something we want to start addressing in the coming years. We had so much data, we decided to create thematic maps to make it very user-friendly. You don't have to be skilled in GIS. Kids have gone on this website to look at some things in their classes. We know that. So you can pick whichever theme you want to go to. Your information is there. It's a little interactive. You can turn on and off things, move it around. But if you're more tech savvy, you do have access to our interactive map. All the data that has fed into these maps and the tools will be available on our Central Florida GIS Clearinghouse for download, so they are publicly accessible. One of the concerns was if we ever do collect data that is not public data, that would be a school district or county or jurisdiction password-protected data. That would definitely not be for the public. And we do have a section in our website. We do have password protection. The other one is the profile snapshots, which provide static reports and statistics and profiles for county, region, state, and even schools if they are available. Just here is a snapshot of the school access studies that Volusia County TPO had done back in 2008 and 2009. And the goal of this is as these new studies come up and reports that this becomes a historical library, so the information is always here. As staff turns over in a jurisdiction or an agency, they can always come back and know that their report has been uploaded in this library. We also created snapshots for the schools. This is, for the counties, this is 2012. It focuses on a variety of things that if you're going after a grant, you can just print it up, attach it to your grant, and you're done. The data is there. In conversation with the school districts, when we start to update this, we're going to do it during the summer to reflect the previous year, so we stay on the school district's schedule, because a lot of this is about busing and transportation and attendance. The Safe Routes Grant Mapper, this was our latest released tool. What we did was we wanted to create a set of standard maps so that if your jurisdiction or agency doesn't have the resources to create the GIS maps that the TPO or some other funding agencies need, you can come here and type in the location of your project and create and click on the different types of maps that you want. There's over 30 maps on here with data. And then you can print the maps and attach it to your application. This makes life much easier, not only for your staff members, but also for the TPO when reviewing various projects, because they're going to be reviewing things consistently. Every application, if they do push this tool, will have the same type of standardized maps. The website has been a great success. It's been open for business, I guess, for about a year. What we really are impressed with is that over 60% of our users come back. They're returning visitors, which they know this place has the information I need. I know I can go here and get the data. I know I can go here and get the report. Like I said, our decision maker page, our resource page, and our tool page are the three most popular pages. And that was our intent, because that's where most of the information that people are going to want to keep coming back for is located. So what is the future of this? We want to make sure that this project, this program, is sustainable across our region for many years to come. By the end of this year, we'll have released the route condition analysis tool. We are currently working on that and piloting it in Lake County. So obviously it's something we want to move to the rest of the region. But it's designed to evaluate at a 30,000 foot level conditions of routes near schools to raise a red flag in order for further conversation to occur and to help in the decision-making process. We also just received the Bike Florida grant, which we will be using to create a how-to video for the webpage, because there is so much stuff on there that we will have that out there to educate staff members and the general public and all the stakeholders about the tools and the data and what they can get from them, from the site. The money that we got from DOT was just seed money, and it ends in October. So moving this forward, we're reaching out to all the local governments and agencies to address how we can keep this going, because we don't want it to become static. It will become useless if the data is not continuously updated, at least on a yearly basis. We've also identified a number of gaps within counties within the region. One county may have all the sidewalks, with a couple cities missing their data. So we want to make sure everybody is on the same page. Everybody can collaborate together and fill these gaps and make this region and this portal just progressive and forward-thinking and create these healthy, walkable communities that our vision, our regional vision, was striving for. And one of the other things, besides just creating this portal for data and resources, it started great conversations between entities and agencies. We've already met with jurisdictions, TPOs, and school districts together at the same time, and DOT. And it's just an amazing feat, I guess, in some counties. So we want to continue that collaboration, because we want to build upon successes, take advantage of opportunities, and not come back later and fix problems because collaboration and communication did not occur to start with. So that's why I'm here today, is to ask for your support for the program. And to consider entering into a memorandum of understanding with the Regional Planning Council to move this forward, to have this as a progressive and sustainable program throughout our region, and for your support. And for you also, please, to take it back to your communities, because it's no not just a county or an agency level. We also need jurisdictional support, because jurisdictions will also be, or cities will also be, utilizing the data and helping to make decisions. Thank you.
Very good. Any questions? Lois?
So clearly we're not asking for action on this item today. The whole point is that we, through the RPC, are looking for a funding mechanism, so there will be a proposal brought back. I wanted to make sure that for those of you that aren't familiar with the site, you have the opportunity to go and take a look at it and see what it does have to offer. If there are things that you think might need to be enhanced, that we take the opportunity to have that discussion as we consider becoming a funding partner for this. And I think one of the things that we do sometimes in local government is we get caught up in our own thing, and we want to create our own site, and we want to own our own. But the reality is, when there are opportunities to have an economies of scale for everybody to fit together, we could all have our own portal and site and throw safety information out there, or as a region, we can work together and have a single site that we're all pointing folks to. In my opinion, that makes a lot of sense. Again, we can contribute all of or put all our funds together and have a really great site, or we can each do it independently, and it creates a lot of confusion sometimes about where do you go to get that information. So again, I think there's certainly some benefit to working together and having a single site that we're all pointing folks to. That being said, we want to make sure that it represents the information that we have available, the activities that we undertake, and the resources and the information that we need.
And
Pat?
Tara, the extent of this is, when you say Central Florida Safe Routes Portal, is it just safe routes to school, or are you going beyond? Because mostly what I think I heard was school-specific. There was...
Being that our initial funding was from the Safe Routes to School program, our initial focus is just on that. But like I said, we understand that you're looking at data for bridges and for economic
right.
development, the same kind of data that you're looking for here. So our goal is that while it is Central Florida Safe Routes, we didn't put to school in there because it's safe routes to everywhere.
Okay.
If you incorporate
okay.
safe routes within that 2-mile radius, especially elementary schools, your whole community is within that 2-mile radius. So our goal is that no matter what type of transportation infrastructure thing you're looking for, you're coming here.
Okay, that's good to hear, because mm-hmm. I think it really goes beyond the schools. It goes to the parks and the playgrounds
mm-hmm.
and other gathering locations. And clearly, Central Florida has a history of killing pedestrians, and we got to stop it. So,
and if I may, our route condition tool, it takes a lot of that into account when we're going to be analyzing route conditions. It's not just the physical infrastructure that we're going to be looking at, it's also accessibility. Are there schools or places of employment within that area that route could be utilized, not just for walking to school, but to accessing other opportunities?
And is this all the counties of the Regional Planning Council?
It's actually District 5 DOT.
Oh, District 5. Okay.
So it's 9 counties.
Okay. Mr. Blaise?
My name is Blaise, CAC chairman. Have you ever looked into the possibility that Voltran could get on school property in the event they have so many kids on the school bus? They could get on the school property to load and unload? Has that ever have been thought about and think about? Because back in the days, eons ago, a lot of students used the municipal city, they call it a municipal bus system, to go to these school sites.
That has come up across the region about utilizing the various alternative modes of transportation for kids to access school. Most of the conversation has taken place for the high schoolers because they're a little bit more mature in order to use those modes of transportation. But as far as Voltran, I'm going to leave that to Stephen to answer if there's been any direct conversations.
Actually, I think we may eventually have to defer to Voltran. There are a lot of restrictions, federal restrictions, as to what public transit can or can't do. Likewise, the way public transit operates versus the way school boards operate in terms of their transportation is very different than the restrictions and limitations.
at some point we can come back and talk about that in some more detail. That's not directly a part of this particular forum.
Okay, Deb?
Just a comment there. As far as transportation goes, the safety issue is a bigger issue. Putting school children on public transportation in today's age, I just cannot imagine that ever happening in today's society right now. I think the liability would be so huge because our bus drivers, as you know, the screenings that we put our school workers through, as we should. So in protection, public protection, safety of our children and where we, how we move them is as important as, you know, where we do it. So I just for the record, I don't ever see that happening.
Okay, any more questions or comments? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, next we have Claudia, the DOT report.
Good morning, Claudia Calzaretta at DOT. There are no new projects to report this month, but I'll take any comments or questions.
Are there any questions for her? Okay. Well, we do have Barb.
I just spoke with Claudia before the meeting just to reiterate, and maybe people in here in Volusia have faced this issue, but in Flagler County, Highway 100 is being paved right now, repaved, and the dedicated bike area to the side has been done. And there are a lot of signs that they have put up to designate the far right lane as the bike path. But in other areas in our county, on other state roads, the bicycle emblem is embedded in the pathway. And I've had complaints brought to me about the plethora of signs that we didn't have before, messing up the landscape on a nice green area when we could just imprint the bike sign on the side of the road. And she's agreed to check on it for us, but I didn't know if there's an issue of why you have it in one area on the state road and not on another.
I've identified the project and the project manager. I'll reach out to Jean Verano and get more specifics. More importantly, why we would put pavement markings versus a sign. I'll get more direction.
Okay. And if you could get that back to Flagler County Administration because it came through the commission?
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you. Thank
you. Okay, and Rick, did you have a question?
Yes, I did.
Yes.
The I-4 Whiting project from Daytona, the land of Daytona.
Which project?
The I-4 Whiting.
That was not
the project.
The project.
Is that on schedule?
It's on schedule. Yes.
Yep.
Thank you.
Okay, very good. Thank you. All right, Executive Director report.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Volusia TPO board retreat that we hold each year was a big success. I think this year we had about 50 participants in that event, and I do have a copy of a draft report that the facilitators have developed for us. We will be refining that and then getting a copy out to everybody. But I wanted to just go over one of the, just briefly, an exercise that we went through for those of you that weren't there during that retreat was to identify a headline. And it was described this way. It's the year 2034, and the region has prospered over the last 20 years. You've been asked to write an editorial describing the contributions of transportation planning to that success. What's the headline you would write, and what are the key points that you would include in the editorial? And each table worked on one, and I just want to mention a couple, because there is a really, now granted, it was a retreat, we were visioning, we weren't drinking, there was no alcohol, it was a morning event. But I want to let you know, one of the headlines, multimodal life, what a relief it is in Volusia County. Successful economic development provides public alternatives to get around. Buses, rails, communities, pedestrian-friendly trails, use time wisely and climate-friendly. Another headline, less is more, successful transportation. River to Sea policy was that no new roads would be built, but a focus on maintenance and repair of what existed in 2014. Integrated alternate transportation includes bike paths, golf carts, monorails, and Sunrail transit. You can get there from here, or anywhere. We're able to go back and check the metrics to verify that we have a linked, connected set of communities. These emphasize all options for travel to all users in a safe manner. All right, I know this is kind of going to the edge. I foreclosed due to lack of demand. There is abundance of alternative modes, diversification of land uses at either end of I-4, and an abundance of transportation choices improve the quality of life for young and old and provide a better family environment. The theme, we need to do a better job providing alternatives. We need to start to measure how we're getting around. We need to protect and preserve what we have. So I just wanted to share that, and again, I'll make that report available to everybody to take a look at. SunRail, we have a community celebration this Saturday. I hope everybody will make an effort to come out to that. It should be a fun and exciting event. It's from 9 to 11 a.m. at the DeBerry Station. And on that note, I would like to ask Heather. There you are. I'd like to come up for just a moment to talk about the feeder service that they're planning through VOTRAN, and there is a handout at each of your stations.
Thank you, Lois. Good morning. Heather Blank from VOTRAN. I want to remind you that VOTRAN has been participating with SunRail as an enterprise to be able to provide our connected service to the SunRail station in DeBerry. So without going through the actual background part of this presentation, I just want to quickly jump to, if you go to page 5 in the presentation, I just want to guide you through the new routes that have been scheduled. This has been developed with the level of funding that has been agreed upon to support this type of service. It will be a commuter service. Please remember, the service is actually going to be Monday to Friday, and the type of service that VOTRAN will be providing will be the morning peak hour service and the afternoon evening peak hour service. So what we were able to do is identify two regular commuter routes that will originate, one in DeLand at the ITS, that's appearing on page 5. And it will stop at regular stops along Woodland all the way down to DeBerry Station. It will not deviate off of the 1792 route. It will continue straight through. That'll be about a 35-minute trip, starting at the ITF in DeLand, which is just newly opened. We are making some route adjustments, so you all know, beginning May 1st will be some adjustments that will allow for that particular facility, the ITF in DeLand, to be used for people going to the train station, but also the route that goes along there. Our regular Route 20 will be turning into the ITF. If you go to the next page, you will see there's going to be another route that's going to be identified originating in DeLand. As we worked with the community and showed the level of service that was being supported with the full funding agreement, there was a request to provide express service. This SunRail 31 is going to originate at Northgate. It will travel directly with limited stops through to the ITF. There will be a stop at the Orange City Veterans Clinic, and it will continue to DeBerry. That travel time will be 35 minutes. In Deltona, if you turn to the next page, you'll see that we have another, what we would call a regular route that will originate at Deltona Shopping Plaza. Rethink, who is working with the District 5 to assist with promoting alternative types of transportation, worked with the Deltona Shopping Plaza a couple of years ago and developed up some park and ride spots there. We will be having a route start there. It will travel along northbound on Normandy to Saxon, westbound to 1792, and continue to DeBerry Station, stop at regular bus stops. That travel time is going to be, lost track of it. travel time will be 47 minutes for that particular trip. And then the associated express bus for Deltona will be originating at DuPont Lakes. Will have limited stops. It will go directly through to DeBary Station with stops at the Deltona City Hall, FDOT Saxon Boulevard Park and Ride. It will not deviate off of Saxon. It will actually continue on Saxon. Go to Marketplace Shopping Center, stay on Saxon, and continue through to DeBary Station. That will be a 52-minute travel time. So this is the service that we will be beginning May 1st. We've been working very hard on getting promotional material and brochures together. We just last week got the final schedule for SunRail. So there's been quite a lot of work being done with Volusia County Community Information to get this information out. Our first opportunity really to present this is going to be at the community event on March 29th. And at the DeBary Station. So everybody who is able to come and appreciate that particular ribbon cutting will be there with the buses.
Pat?
Yes, Pat?
Yeah. Heather, at what point will we review the success of these alignments, these routings? Because I'm very concerned about the...
Great question.
52-minute travel time on an express in Deltona. That's just not going to get people on that bus.
Great question, Pat. We starting out with this and showing it in a separate set of materials that we're putting out as public information. We understand it's new. We understand there's going to be a demand that's not really that well known at this point in time. And what we plan on doing is every few months or so, taking a look at how things are working and what adjustments can be made. So we're expecting, even as soon as September, that there might be some demand for changes in time frames and so on, even in alignments. So we will continue to work, and as you find information that you'd like to discuss either with planning in my office or Steve Scherer, that's what we plan to approach it as. This is a new thing. This is a pilot. And we have to start somewhere. We just got the schedule last week. And this is what we'll put out on the road starting May 1st.
Okay. Heather, typically, SoTran monitors statistics monthly?
We actually will.
Change three times a year, right?
We monitor, actually, this type of service, we probably will be monitoring at least monthly, maybe more frequently than that. We'll be probably looking at the first week to see what the first week of service is going to look at whenever we have new service. But I want to assure you that not only do we have the actual ridership off of the fare box, but we have information by way of what we call automated passenger counters. Each time somebody boards and deboards the bus at a particular stop, we can understand the level of activity at that particular location. So that's why, as Lois did mention, there are three opportunities normally through the year that we can make changes. But certainly this particular effort we're understanding is a pilot, and we're fully expecting that there will be some things that we want to do by September 1st.
Hey, Rick?
Yeah, a citizen from Lake Helen called Votran, and they asked them, how do we get to the bus to SunRail?
They would have the nearest bus service situated on 1792, so that would be how they would have to get there to get to 1792. We don't have bus service in Lake Helen at this time.
Okay. Any more questions? Okay, thank you. All right. Lois, I guess
thank you very much.
Wrap it up here.
I had a question.
I'm sorry, Barbara.
Presuming that somebody decided they wanted to stop riding in their car to catch SunRail and go to work in somewhere along the route in Orlando, and they needed to access to get to a Votran, and it's too far to walk, are there provisions made, let's say, for these express routes to have a bicycle locking device locations? If somebody was really going to try to commute
by bus and rail, but they needed to do more than just walk to a bus station. Are there opportunities for bicycling to those locations?
Each of the Votran vehicles that is acquired has a position on the vehicle for two bus racks.
But that would require them to take their bike with them.
But the situation for the actual roadside of locking the bicycles, that's going to be something that the individual probably has to take a pretty good look at, where they're going to be actually accessing to understand what type of secure situation they have for locking their bicycle. If we do find that there is a particular stop that has more demand for bicycle lockups, we could look at working with the cities to try to develop that opportunity to provide bike racks and improvements associated with that particular activity at that stop.
Okay, thank you. All right, Lois.
Okay, just trying to move quickly then towards the end. I think you all have seen, we received a letter from the governor's office endorsing our reapportionment plan. So that's very exciting. We are still working through the three agreements that are required to actually make that happen. Those were not quite as forthcoming, so they're still under review. It doesn't appear as though, to give everybody enough review time on those, that we will have this all completed for the April agenda, but we will certainly be moving forward by the May meeting, if not before. Legislative update, we have a couple of items that have been on our legislative priorities that have had bills introduced. One is HB 0013, which is relating to rental car surcharges. There is a companion Senate bill 0484, if you're interested in rental car surcharges. There is also a bill that's been submitted changing or proposing a change to the use of handheld devices and wireless devices to escalate that from a secondary offense to a primary offense. That's Senate Bill 0322. There's also a bill that's been submitted relating to child safety, which also was a priority of this TPO, Senate Bill 0454. And then finally, there is some activity that isn't specific to transportation, but is about public meetings and prohibiting any actions to be taken that weren't fully agendaed, except under emergency circumstances, and that's Senate Bill 0718. There are times that action of a more minimal nature is taken, so that would preclude that opportunity from occurring. Again, those are some items that you may be interested in. We had several members absent today because of the Big Bike Florida event, and hopefully at next month's meeting we'll get some feedback on how that event went. Today is beautiful, so I'm sure they're out there enjoying it. That was the event that included a loop around the racetrack. And finally, for those of you that are staying for a 10:30 budget subcommittee meeting, just a reminder, don't get enthusiastic and run out the doors. Thank you.
Okay, any questions? All right, well, do we have any member comments? If we go around, anyone that has a burning desire to make a comment? All right, other than that, go ahead, Deb.
First of all, my husband did ride just yesterday. He was out there with Lee and the team and his guys riding the bike floor and said it was a wonderful day, but they just did the one day around the track. Very impressed with how it was organized and set up. And just want to clarify a member that spoke during public comment time on the FAA hearing regarding a commercial spaceport in New Smyrna Beach. I have to go on the record with that. The comment was made that there was overwhelming support against it. That just is not accurate. Very honestly, the FAA, if you look at the testimony given and submitted in those that were in attendance, according to public record, it was probably pretty evenly split, to be very accurate. And those that were in support of this, there were almost 700 people at that particular event in New Smyrna Beach at the high school. There were multiple chambers of commerce with resolutions of support, cities with resolutions of support, the VMA, Team Volusia, UCF, Embry-Riddle, the Burnside Tech School down there, multiple cities, retirees. It was exciting to think that here in Volusia County, the FAA was here to talk about the possibility of a commercial spaceport. So I just want to go on the record that it was not overwhelmingly against this particular project. I think that needs to be stated going forward. And where we are now is it's in the hands of the feds. They will determine this environmental impact statement, whether the state can issue a license for such a facility. But it's at the federal level now. So comments like that, I think, just need to be very accurate going forward. Thank you.
And with no further comments, do I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
So moved. All right. Thank you very much.